Welcome to Book Reporter Talks To, where we host in-depth conversations with authors about the books that we love, coming to you wherever you may be. Hi, I'm Carol Fitzgerald from readinggroupguys.com, a website from the Book Report Network, and the host of the Book Reporter Talks To video podcast series. And I want to welcome you to our third Bookachino Live book group event, where our guest this evening is Kim Michelle Richardson, the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Bookwoman of Troublesome Creek. We've heard from so many of you about being excited about being here tonight. I got so many notes, even up to today, of please, I'd like to be part of this event. My book club read this book. And as a result, we are just so excited about having you and being able to talk to Kim Michelle tonight. The format tonight's going to be as follows. Let me start by noting we are going to assume that everyone has read the book. So if spoilers come out, just know it's because we assume that the book has been read. That's the reason this is a book club. You can have your wine, but we're also assuming that you've read the book. I'm going to begin with a discussion with Kim Michelle with four members of our audience joining us live to share their questions. And then we're going to take audience questions from the Q&A. So if you see down below the place where you can add a question, feel free to drop questions in there during the event. We'll go to Q&A at the end. And Austin, who's our, as I call, voice of God, will be jumping on and going through the questions and making sure they're ones that we haven't already talked about or whatever. So make sure you're putting those in there during the night. With that housekeeping behind us, let us welcome Kim Michelle Richardson to the stage.
Hey.
And here you are. It is so nice to see you. Thank you so much for joining us. The enthusiasm for this book, the people excited about hearing from you tonight, I am just thrilled, absolutely thrilled. So welcome, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Book Reporter, Carol, everybody that made this happen, and to my readers out there.
So I'm going to start and jump right in with a question. Bookwoman of Troublesome Creek draws on the history of the pack horse librarians. And these were people, mostly women, who delivered reading material to some of the most remote places in the Appalachian Mountains as part of the WAPA project during the Great Depression. Now, what inspired you to find this story? Like, how did you find the story that featured these librarians as protagonists?
Well, first of all, greetings from Kentucky. I'm a Kentuckian, and these are my people. This is my place. All my books are set in Kentucky. And it was a story that I wanted to do a long time ago. I've always known about the Kentucky Pack Horse Librarians, as well as my blueskin people here. And it was a way to lift these people up and pay tribute, and also to dispel ignorance about the blueskin people and, show what has actually happened with them. And these women, the Kentucky Pack Horse Librarians, and very few men, the world didn't know about them. They were nowhere to be found, really. And so it was about six years ago. It took 5 years to write the story, and thousands and thousands of hours of research, and just some hellacious times during it in 12 to 16 hour days to do it right, because I knew it was such an important part of history and it was my Kentucky people history. So it was very, very important to me.
Was this something that you had heard about when you were growing up? Was this something that was taught in, I always think that in fourth grade, you do history of your state. Did they talk about this? Was this something that you'd heard about?
It was something that wasn't, you would hear about it once in a great while. Like, I think in the early 90s or late 80s, a Kentucky journalist did a nice story on them, and it was a wonderful, and I always just kept it in the back of my mind. And I would think, wow, because the story was so unique because it featured fierce, brave women and in a treacherous landscape, in poverty, battling their own pandemics, and during Kentucky's most violent era, the Bloody Coal Mine Wars. So, and poverty was just rampant. There was no fairy tale in Kentucky during that time. So, and literacy was down, and it was just a really hard time. But yet these women started this program. You know, Roosevelt said, okay, this program did actually start in 1913. The Kentucky Federation of Women's Club, they went to a wealthy coal baron here in Kentucky, and they said, this is what we want to do, take horses and ride up into the hills and dispense literacy. And will you fund it? And he said, absolutely. But John Mayo, he died a year later, and with him, the program died. And it wouldn't be until, again, in 1935, the women went to the WPA Roosevelt and said, look, we want to start this initiative again, you know. And he said, sure, but here's what I'll do. I'll give those women, to put them back to work, I'll give them $28 a month. But no horses, no books, no places to house the books. That's all I get. So wow. It had to grow, and they had to think of ingenious, clever ways to make scrapbooks and so forth, and penny funds and solicit books from around the country.
And I love when they're out delivering the books and people are asking, could you get me this? Could you get me that? And they're trying to, as librarians, trying to bring the people, oh, I found this thing that you'll like. And it might be a newspaper that's months old, but I think it'd be something that you'd enjoy. And I think that when we have so much available to us right now, there were times when I was reading that story and thinking of these heartfelt little moments of everything from, I'll trade a lifesaver for you, this little lifesaver, but you're bringing me literacy. It was amazing.
Yes, they were literally dying of the pellagra then, but they had such a hunger for food, for the soul, for books, you know, for the printed word.
You know, your novel is also a powerful story rooted in historical fact. You know, Cussie Mary Carter and her family are based on real people who suffered from a little known blood disorder. When did you first hear about the blue Fugates? When did that first come across to you?
Fugates have always been a part of our history here. Again, I'm a Kentuckian. And little was known about them until the 60s when Dr. Kaelin discovered, you know, these people. And the story kind of reflects on them. They were taught in classes, biology classes, as examples and so forth. So people do know around the world, but didn't really know, you know, too much about the genetic disorder, methemoglobinemia.
I was going to try to pronounce it. I decided I was going to let you do that.
Say methemoglobinemia, it can be acquired through using drugs or your diet or so forth, or congenital, which was the Fugates, congenital.
What happened there? So you did this incredible amount of research. What was that process like? Did you have a bunch of books, or do you still have all these research materials? Did you go to a research library? What did you do to research?
Oh, Lord, the research started out, like I said, it took 5 years. I spoke to hematologists, doctors, I had to go back to the hematologist several times to learn to say the word, you know, and also discussions with the blue-skinned people of Kentucky. It was also, I visited coal miners, interviewed fire tower watchers. I studied the food, the floral, the fauna, and, you know, I knew it was so important. Like I said, I knew it couldn't be rushed, and these women, especially the Pack Horse librarians, deserved that, you know, extensive research and just being absolutely sure, because I was writing it for the people of Kentucky first and foremost. And I just kept that in mind. A lot of people, also the last year I went to live in Appalachia, part of Appalachia, just so I could finish, you know, wrapping up the book and relax and get it all where I need it to, and get the feel too with talking with the old timers and so forth. But then I fell off the mountain, and I say this in all my interviews, and I broke my arm in 7 spots. And there wasn't a really like a cool bear chase me story or a snake chase me. It was nothing that cool. It was just simply toting down some Pyrex dishes for an elderly mountain lady. And it's nary scratch on the Pyrex, but seven breaks.
Wow. And
then it wasn't 2 weeks later, my husband came down with serious Lyme. So we had to get off that mountain and hightail it back and wrap this thing up.
Wow. When your arm broke, did you heal quickly? Like, could you still type? Could you still?
You know, it was really miserable. It happened on a holiday weekend in a very tiny, tiny town. And I went 7 days without so much as an aspirin. And then my friend, author Sarah Grun, she got me a surgeon. And got me in to see a surgeon. I could, you know, and I had to drive some, but we got that. But it was pretty bad. You know, it's pretty painful.
Yeah.
But I'm fine.
Yeah. And it's like, okay, well, why is your book delayed? Well, I broke my arm and my wrist in seven places. You know, that's a good reason.
No, it wasn't delayed. And one thing about Bookwoman is, a lot of people don't realize this book actually sold in 2017 and that it mirrors, you know, the climate of the world right now is so wild. I would have never dreamed that. My dream while writing this book is, if I had planted seeds of kindness, courage, and compassion in a somewhat charged and charged world, then I had done everything I could. I had no idea we'd be in a pandemic. We'd be under racial, you know, strife again, everything just going on, you know. So it was very, you know.
Yeah, because as I was reading the book, because I read it again recently, and as I was reading through the book, it does mirror a lot of what we're going through right now. And it mirrors, it shows that, like, what have we really learned going forward about being kind to one another? And what have we been learned about accepting one another? And it just is so interesting that the same themes were still coming up today.
Yes, you know, and we've got, you know, women's rights and sexism, nationalism, racial injustices, so much. And it's like, when will we ever learn? I guess that's why I write about historical social injustices in my books. And that's why I keep writing it. Hopefully it will click with some people and make a difference.
Yeah. And people will actually sit there and say, well, wait a second, this has gone on before. Why are we still doing this? And take a look at themselves about what they're doing. Because you realize the women who were doing this were so selfless. It's like, this is just going to try and do good for others. And it was being scrappy all day long. There was not a day where they got down there and everything that they wanted was there. And it never turned that way the entire time you're reading the book. It was never the newspaper, the books and everything were lined up the way they wanted them. It was constantly trying to feed, like, get exactly what they wanted for their people with nothing.
Right, right. And the people, you know, it wasn't long ago in 64 when President Johnson came to that part of the woods, you know, in Kentucky and declared his war on poverty there. And not much has changed there. They still have unclean drinking water and spots and bad roads and poverty and everything. And then the wealthy people that come in, rush in to stand on the poor man's back to stand taller, leaving coal people. So we still have a lot of that going on.
Yeah, the cycle has not been broken. And as much as we sit there and say, it happened in the 30s, we tried in the 60s, we're trying. It's the way the cycle really, and I think that many of us who have been around a long time see any kinds of strides being made now is how can we just keep this going? What can we actually keep doing and paying attention to? Because sure, the pandemic was a real leveler of everybody, everybody could get sick. It wasn't just certain people.
Right, right.
What was going on? Well, we're going to go to Patty Jo, one of our readers, with a question. So Patty's magically going to appear on the screen in a moment. Hi, Patty Jo.
Hi, Kim. I really enjoyed the relationship between Cussie and her mule, Junio, and how her mule protected her from that reverend that was looking out for her. And Did most book women ride horses, or did some ride mules, like Cussie?
Mm-hmm. Some rode horses and then some rode mules. But for me, when I started thinking about the book, it was really important to give Cussie the strongest animal. So mules live longer. They're more durable. They live, you know, they can live 40 years. They eat less. They require less. And they're not stubborn. They're very protective and they're big preservationists. So it was really important. And one thing, the last thing on doing all my research, the years I was going to go ride a mule. But the day before I broke my arm, Sarah Gruen and I were going to go ride mules. And I was so mad about that, but you know, but anyway, I did talk to mule skinners and research books, and I wanted Cussie Mary just to have a really strong protector.
Any other question, Patty? I think you've got one more burning question for her.
I do, and this is behind you. Is that a real Britain phone booth?
I don't think so. My husband got that several decades ago, and it's turned now. I used to, when the kids were little and the other kids in the neighborhood came over, we have an old phone that was hooked up, and it does work and everything. And then it's actually a bookshelf. I'm in my kitchen, so it's actually all my recipe books.
Okay. I also love that there was that moment where they used to dial the phone, like they used to actually dial and knew how to do that.
And I have a little stool for them here. So they could get in there and they could see the phone, they could dial it. But you had to show them.
That'd be the cool mom thing to have at the house. I want a phone like that.
Yeah, and then they shut the door and talk to their parents or whoever, you know, it's fun.
It's funny because you see like rotary phones, and there was a couple of years ago, we did one of those hunts. It was like, you've got to get out of the magic room. You've got to get there. And one of the clues had something to do with a rotary dial phone. And anybody who was really young was looking like this. And we were like, oh, we're just going to win this round. I was with Linwood Barkley and I go, oh, we're winning this round. We actually know what to do with this. I didn't know any of the other clues. So thank you so much, Patty Jo. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So how long were the women's routes? Like how many miles a day would they typically ride?
Oh, they could ride, you know, now one thing, and this is true if even you're traveling to the mountains and through the mountains. So the distance maybe is 5 miles and you think that shouldn't take but 5 minutes. It could take 20 minutes because you're going around switchbacks and up and down and other across creeks and everything. So over 100 a week, you know.
So you live in Kentucky, novels are there. It's been such fertile ground for you for writing stories, but you writing very, very authentically. What was the passion about writing? Like you're so proud? I know you're very proud of your state, but you want to also make sure it's presented authentically. Yes. Is that one of the reasons that you've really said, this is where my home is? And you really make it feel like that in reading your books.
Right. As I said, I think the most important thing when my ARCs early editions went out, right away I received a letter to my publisher and me from a Fugit, and just tell me how beautiful and how he loved the book and how it lifted him up. And so I said, no matter what else anybody else in the world says, I'm going to paste that on my computer and just remember that. I did what I accomplished, you know, I set out to do what I wanted to do and accomplished it. So I think that was the most important thing to me. And it's something that's I've never forgot. So my voice isn't for everyone. I'm a Kentuckian, you know, but that made me feel proud. Also, I knew it was very important to get my Kentucky history right. Everything felt very important about this book. I didn't know why, but I just felt that this was my life's work. I still consider it. It was something I just enjoyed and so forth. But right down to, we have some, like the title was changed several times. And first it was called A Familiar Bluette, and then my agent didn't care for that. And then we went, she wanted to call it Kentucky Blue. And I said, no, you can't call it that. And she said, no, no, everybody in the office loves it and says it's fine. And I said, my ball fans here will kill me. They'll burn couches on my lawn if you name that book Kentucky Blue, you know, basketball. Mm-hmm. So then it went through the borrowing branch, and the publisher thought that young people would know that the libraries were called borrowing branches. And so then they named it The Bookwoman of Troublesome Creek.
And just perfect title. It's really just the perfect title, because she is at the heart of the story.
And we went through several covers too. This was the first one.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, it had a lot of blue in there. And sometimes book people will come in and say, we don't like this. You know, we want it changed. And Barnes and Noble came in and said they didn't like that. So then it, of course, went to that.
So that was the second one. So the first one, and then it went right to the second one.
Yeah, the arts came out in this, and Barnes and Noble said, no, we don't like that. Change it to the publisher. So then they came out with this. And then Canada came out with this, which I love this cover so much. It was show of the ostracization, the prejudice. What is this woman being shunned for? You know, it was just a very literal metaphor, I thought. So powerful, haunting, and sad and beautiful. Today, on my anniversary, this came in the mail from the U.S. Embassy in Moscow.
Oh, wow.
That's the Moscow edition, a Russian edition. So I love that. The people in Russia love me. And, you know, it was kind of weird saying I've done a Russian deal, you know.
Yeah. I've done a Russian deal. Yeah, that's definitely it.
But anyways, the U.S. Embassy sent me a letter, and they asked if I would speak to the Russian audiences. So I'm going to do that next month, June.
Oh, that's terrific. That's terrific.
I know. So I can't believe it, you know, that they're going to be able to even understand me.
They're probably translators or whatever. But you know what's really interesting is the way the book resonates differently in different parts of the world, the way they interpret the covers. And it can be something completely different. And it's funny you say that about Barnes and Noble. There was a woman there that was running the fiction department, Cecily Hensley. And when she was there, if she said no was the cover, that wasn't the cover. Like, you might think you were done and you were right back to the beginning on what you were going to do and pick the cover. So I know that moment, because there are many times we'll be building a website for an author or whatever, and they say, that's not the cover anymore. We're changing the cover. So, you know, the one thing you didn't shy away from was describing how difficult life was for Cussie Mae and the other Hill people. And there are a lot of bleak moments in this book, but there are also these moments of kindness and grace that are really woven into those moments. Was it challenging to write the hard scrapple life with those hopeful moments? Like, did you have a moment where it's like, we're down here, we need to bring the story up, or was it just something natural that would happen as you were writing?
It was a very slow process. Like I said, there would be sometimes 12 to 16 hour days of writing, and I'm a person that can absolutely sit on something, a paragraph, for 2 or 3 days and trying to get the rhythm of it. But no, I did not have any problem. You know, there's no romanticism in poverty. You know, you can try to write it, but you're not a Kentuckian, and that's going to come through. But there is none. And as a person myself, you know, I'm a survivor of poverty, abuse, homelessness, and more. And so I can relate to marginalized people, my people, you know, really well. When you grow up this way and you can experience pain and you can feel their pain deeply. Mm-hmm. So it really wasn't a problem for me.
And then
my people.
And then marrying it with the really hopeful moments was something I think that made the book so special, because there'd be a downtrodden something happening all day long, and then you could uplift it with a little tiny moment, like that lifesaver moment I'm going to come back to, just these little tiny bits of sparkle and happiness.
Yeah. And I think that was the grit of the Kentucky people. You know, their lives were hard and their work was hard, but they would maybe find joy in something throughout the day or at home that evening, whatever, you know. Their music and food was had its own life, you know, and brought people together. So
life there is still hard, like compared to the 30s, like compared to the timing of this book. What's it like now? Have things become better? Is there still the same level of poverty? Is there the same level of danger, like danger with like what was going on in the mines?
Yes, there is. This week I was speaking to a coal miner, and this was fascinating. She's a female coal miner, and her mother also was a female coal miner. So we were talking, but yes, it is a lot has not changed. Not enough has changed, Carol. As I said, in 64, when he came to declare that war on poverty, nothing really changed. We have opioid crisis, unclean, unsafe drinking water, still poverty, people again coming in and using the Kentucky Man, stealing from the people. You know, this has gone on, and boy, you know, can I relate to that?
Yeah. So nothing's actually, you know, completely changed. You know, I found it interesting as one of the moments of like this is the company was paying people in script to tie them to the company. You had to go to the company's store. Mm-hmm. Was that something that was typical that you would see with the mines during those times?
Yes. And I had some script out here. I meant to show you. Yes. The coal company owned the Kentucky people. You know, you need to go to eat at the diner or pick up something at the feed store, you know, that check came in script, you know, you had to spend the script. But this was also during my research, this is the courting candle.
Oh, I love it.
This is a little antique one. And what would happen, I don't know if you can see it coming up and down.
Mm-hmm. So
that was just a little fun thing I wanted to add, you know, to the story to make it a little more unique. But that's how that kind of worked. And
lighting a courting candle on your anniversary, is that some token?
Yeah.
Oh, that's fabulous. That's fabulous. So Mary Cussey's the book's protagonist, but there's also this really vivid cast of secondary characters that leap off to the page as well. Did you feel really close to any one of those characters as you were writing? I know you probably feel close to all of them, but the one person that really spoke to you a lot?
You know, that was one thing. I got to talk to editors before the book sold, and they were interviewing me. I was interviewing them, and I know one big editor, you know, didn't think somebody might need to be there, but I've been with them for 5 years. No one was leaving. No one, you know, no one. I wasn't giving up anybody. But I loved old Loretta.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved little Angeline, you know. They were all just precious to me, you know.
And the way their stories wove in and out, they all had their own personalities. Like you saw them distinctly. And there's a lot of times when there's a book that has an ensemble character, it's like this, you don't remember them, but you wrote them so vividly. I could see that plucking one of them out was going to be like pulling the string and all the sock fell apart. You know, it wasn't going to happen.
Yes. I was not going to give them up. I knew nobody was leaving, you know, like RC, the fire tire lookout. Somebody had said, well, we don't need him. Oh, yes, we do. Mm-hmm. I had already interviewed an old mountain man who was a fire tower lookout, and he had dinner with me one lonely Christmas Eve, and I'm like, he told me his story, and I couldn't believe it, and I go, there's my RC, you know.
Mm-hmm. This is what somebody.
So he wasn't going anywhere. Nobody was going anywhere.
Well, I think one of the very intriguing characters to me was Doc. He's got this real complicated relationship with Blewett. And at times, you feel like he's a little bit exploitative because he knows what he's trying to find out. He's trying to see if this works. She's like the guinea pig that he's sitting there working with. Creating him and his motivations, and that all changes over the course of the book. Was that something that you wrestled with, like how you were going to weave him in and out of the story?
I knew, understandably, for a reason, for, you know, I was researching the original Doc Kaywin, you know, and what I learned about him, just very little. I knew that was something I was going to do with Doc, you know. I knew he was going to want to seek the fame and fortune in his medical journals and so forth. But I knew he had to become a friend to the Carters, the blue-skinned people.
Well, I'm going to go to Deborah Elizabeth with a question here. Deborah Elizabeth Moore. So wait for her to pop up on the screen. And, you know, in between, so when you were doing this, were there notes all over, or were you writing, like, you know, in order? What were you doing?
No, I'm not organized. There's a million sticky notes, napkins, envelopes, bills with all laying around, and two rescue dogs coming in and out. And it's just very slow and meticulous, you know.
A lot of time spent on one paragraph.
right. You know, and just until I felt this was the right voice, or this felt right, or this doesn't feel right, you know, it was just very important for me, you know, and I just can't stress that enough.
Important way. Hey, Deborah, Debbie, you've got your question.
Hi, Debbie.
Hi. In your book, you have two overlapping storylines: the experience of being a bookwoman during the Depression and the experience and discrimination that the blue people suffered. Did you initially intend to write both stories, or did you start with one and then get on to the other? And which did you initially tend to write?
Both of them, because I write, all my stories reflect historical Kentucky. So it was a way, again, because in 80 years, no one had heard of the Pack Horse Librarians, and the Fugits, the blue-skinned people, were misunderstood, made fun of by the news, ABC News, a bunch of media. And I knew that fear and ignorance breeds toxicity and hate into cultures. And I knew that's what was going on. So it was very important for me to lift them up. And what better way than an honorable Pack Horse Librarian?
Thank you.
So the book, a lot of people speak in strong and distinct Appalachian dialect, and writing that dialect can be difficult. And in the hands of somebody less skilled, it would come off as something inauthentic or cliched. And we're going to go to Tracy Bramwell for her question here, because I felt the voice was so dead on, but she had a very interesting perspective when she was doing something with the book. So I'm going to let Tracy tell her story.
Hi, Tracy. Hi, Kim Michelle. Because your book was so popular at the library, I couldn't get the print version or the ebook. So I started by listening to the audiobook. And when my loan ran out, then I had to switch to the ebook because that was the only one available. And then actually finished reading with the audiobook. And I enjoyed, like Carol said, enjoyed the Kentucky dialect very much, especially when listening to it. But my question is, how do you research a dialect from a remote area? And how do you, as a writer, craft or encode the words so that they sound like you want them to? You know, what is your process for creating some of those inventive spellings and letting us hear the dialect?
Thank you. First of all, I want to tell you the audio edition has received so much praise. I got to pick the actress, and that's Katie Shore. She had done another of my Appalachian novels. And she's actually a Brooklyn baby from Brooklyn. And I knew, I loved her. I knew she did a good job on my other book, Got Pretty in the Tobacco Field. So when they said, who do you want? I said, I want Katie again. And she's just fantastic. That's something difficult, you know, about language. And Carol, I was interviewing a big publisher, and we were talking and everything, and we got down to the part where she says, well, I don't know about the language, you know. And she's from New York, and she said, I'll have to ask my mother. And so when I hung up, I called my agent. I said, not for $1 million. Mm. Not for any amount of money. I had already stripped the Appalachia people of their music, their beats, and their lyrics. I mean, this book is way scaled back to what it really should be. But I had already stripped them so much, it wasn't fair to keep stripping that music. So I'm a Kentuckian, but I can go into different pockets of Kentucky. I have relatives in another pocket of Kentucky. I can't even understand him, you know. So that's it. But I'm blessed because I have a really nice agent, and I had an editor that let me write it and say it the way it should be said, instead of making it proper for the rest of this. That's not the Kentucky people. That's what other people want you to say. Well, that there's no rule about that. You know, everybody has their language. Wherever you're from, there's beats, there's music to it. You can tell your people from other people. So it was really important. But yet I wanted to be mindful that not the whole world can understand Kentucky or speak Kentucky or whatever. I mean, I know that I can call California, and they're, by the end of the conversation, they're laughing at me just to take an order because they can't understand me. This is so, I mean, it's been, you know, I've had my days with it, but it was really important to be depicted honestly and accurately, all of it, you know.
Thank you.
And I think that does make a such difference when you're listening to audio, especially if the voice is authentic and it's coming across. And sometimes when you find the right narrator, you do want them to be doing all your books because you know they can speak the language and they can really do it. So they're performers. They're actually known as, it's not just the narrator, it's like the performer of the audio book. And it's really interesting to hear because what they actually have to do is take the story and make it come alive. And if you've got the right accents or whatever, you're able to do that. So thank you, Tracy. Excellent question. Thank you.
It was. Thank you.
So the book's a historical novel, but many of the themes, such as the effects of racism, prejudice, and the unfortunate legacy of generational poverty, continue to resonate today. So when you have readers reading this book, what do you want them to take away when you're sitting and having a discussion? Is it thinking about these subjects more, doing something, empowering?
Yes, and I think, you know, that was the whole thing. As I said earlier, we're living in such a charged world. And when I finished this in 2017 and sold it, I said, if I had planted seeds of kindness, courage, and compassion, I did everything I could do. And that was in 2017 when this book sold. So it was very important to me. Another thing, too, was it wasn't, you know, so we had sexism, women's rights, racism, everything going on in this book, which is pretty much every day in the world, you know. But it was much more than that. It's how we treat people who are different from us differently. That was my bottom line throughout the whole book, you know. Why do we do that, you know, treat people different who are different than us? And then fear and ignorance, again, breeds hate and toxicity into cultures. It's just, at some point, it's just got to stop.
And it was so interesting.
It's no matter if you're disabled, what color, what religion, whatever. It's just beyond me, you know.
Mm-hmm. And I love that Queenie was going to Philadelphia to get a different job. She was out. She was having this moment of opportunity, and everyone like couldn't believe that she would be the one that would be accepted up there, that she would be the one going to school. And you saw the letters going back and forth, and it was, you can get yourself out of a situation. There was a moment of hope in seeing what she was doing there of, yes, it is possible. You just have to have the right moment, and you have to have the right gumption to want to go do it and just say, I'm going to take that step. Courage.
Right.
Working from courage. So we're going to go to Michelle with a question, but I have one for you first while we're warming up. Michelle, are you working on something now? Are you buried in research?
Yes, I am. I've been working on something, and we've had such a great response from Bookwoman that we're going to continue it on in a standalone and a sequel coming in 2022.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, fantastic. That's a lot to think. Oh, that's great for this audience to hear.
It will take, you know, we'll get to find out what happens to Jackson, Cussie, and Honey. And we'll have a very unique setting with some very unique women doing some jobs most people have never heard of. So it'll be, my agent doesn't want me to talk about it at the time. We're going to keep quiet about it, but it's going again be set in Kentucky, be very unique story and some very unique things going on.
Oh, well, we're glad you gave a glimpse of that to us tonight. So thank you. Lots to look forward to. Michelle, what go with your question?
Hi, Michelle.
Hey. Hi. I was wondering, with your experience now as an author, if you could travel back in time and give yourself some advice when it comes to writing or publishing, what would that be?
Oh, well, I guess, I don't know, just to turn everything off and trust your own gut. It seems like, you know, I didn't go to any school to get a degree for writing. I was too busy trying to survive poverty and stay alive for all that. But, you know, just, you know, as I said earlier about the language of my people and so forth, years ago, I might have given on that, but this time I knew I wasn't going to give on certain things. And I'm really blessed. I have a wonderful agent. She understands that I'm more of a kitchen table author. When I'm speaking, it's like we're talking across the kitchen table. That's my writing. That's what I always wanted to be. It's not going to be fancy. It's not going to be fancy $2 words. It's just going to be me, you know, speaking and telling you my story honestly, lyrically, as I can.
Yeah. So I guess your big advice is to stick to be yourself, to be yourself, because, you know, there are a lot of writers that they start to change. They become what the market wants them to be, or they become where they're chasing what's going on. You know, somebody said to me, what do you think the next big thing is to be writing? I heard an author say this the other day, like, you know, where do you think it's going to go? And you try to figure out if you can be authentic, if you're looking where it's supposed to go instead of where it's coming from inside of you. And it's just really interesting to think about that.
And I would never want to write what somebody else is writing, or even I want to be authentic enough that I can think of my own stuff to write. I don't want to write what somebody else is writing. And I'm blessed. I have a landscape here in Kentucky. We have enough strange people and things and traditions and myths and lore that I guess I can.
There's a lot for you to mine there.
Yeah, it's very rich. I mean, we had the Frontier Nursing Services that started. That's with the nurses on Pike Course, you know, in the 1920s here. We had the Moonlight Schools, you know, where they walked up paths to travel to school only when the moon was out. We had so many wild and rich history here.
You know, it's writing about a time that people don't really think about. They don't really know enough about a part of the country that a lot of people have never traveled to, will not be traveling to. You know, you can sit there and write a story about California, and a lot of people will go there. You can write a story about the East Coast, New York. You know, they're just locations. But you heard, I haven't heard of a lot of people saying, I'm going on vacation to Kentucky, and I want to go study, like, you know, what's happening in Kentucky. And as a result, you're bringing that forward to people, of showing them what the state is.
Right. And believe it or not, Kara, I've received a ton of letters, people wanting to go to Troublesome Creek, Kentucky. They're taking a vacation. They're going through it. They're going to stay. So it's been crazy.
Yeah, it's just been this very different thing. Mm-hmm. Michelle, thanks. That was a really good question because, you know, like, you don't want to change for it. You don't.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And now we're going to go to some audience questions. So Austin, have you been looking through those? And are there some questions for us?
Yes, there are a lot of great questions. Ooh. I'm going to do my best not to ask questions that have already been asked. All right, so I guess we could start with, do any of the scrapbooks still exist in museums today?
Yes, they do exist in Roosevelt's Library. They are also, if you go on my website, there's a companion booklet that you can download. It's free, and you can see beautiful scrapbooks, and yeah, they do, and they're lovely.
Great. And Kim, just let me know if you think that you've answered any of these already. Carol asks, how did the people of Kentucky or people in your community respond to your book?
They love the book. If they love it, they're proud of it. And as I said, the few kids that, you know, inspired the blue-skinned, I've heard from many of them. Several of them are librarians, as a matter of fact. And they love the book. It's lifted them up. They think it's beautiful. And that's all I could have hoped for.
Mm-hmm. Right. Beth says, I love the Pyrex story. And then I think there's a bit of a spoiler, so I won't. Well, can I say the spoilers?
Yes, you can do spoilers.
Okay, everybody here has read it, so I guess I can.
Got it.
Beth says, I love the Pyrex story, sad about the broken arm though, but I am a big Pyrex collector, so love the story.
Yes, nary a scratch on that Pyrex. It was, I could have been a spokesperson for them.
With your arm.
Let's see. Teresa asks, are there bluettes still living today?
Are there what? I'm sorry.
Blue individuals.
Yes, as I just said, several of them are librarians, and yes, I know many of them.
Mm-hmm. Maureen asks, you end chapter 46 with this statement, dreams were for books. This seems disingenuous to Cussie a bit, who always I felt had dreams, even if left unspoken. So why did you choose to voice the sentiment for Cussie at the time?
Well, obviously her man is on the ground and being taken away by the sheriff. And as I said, there's no romanticism in Kentucky 1930. So yes, at that moment, Cussie was facing losing everything. Honey, her husband, she'd already lost so much. Her father, Angeline, there was been a lot of tragedy for her.
A different Carol asks, where did they get their books, magazines, periodicals, other similar entertainment?
Yes, they got them from the Boy Scouts, the women's clubs, Cincinnati, Kentucky, and St. Louis, anywhere they wrote. And they also had penny funds where they raised money, your pennies, to buy used tattered books.
Ella says, speaking of recipes, I went back through my old family reunion recipe books, and there was the Bible recipe with several different versions, and they were delicious. Did you grow up with this cake?
No, I did not. You know, I wasn't born when the Pack Horse Librarians were born. I feel like it, though, but no, I did not grow up with the scripture cake. But again, if you go on my website, you can see, you know, in that companion booklet, there's a recipe for it. And we've made it for book clubs, and it's delicious.
Yeah, that sounds great. Ellen also talks about the recipe. She says, I found a recipe online for a scripture cake and made the recipe for a friend's get together after our second vaccines. Oh, it was fairly expensive cake to make, so she was surprised that Cussie tossed it away at the social gathering when she felt shunned. Let's see, Kathy says, when the medication became available to control or mitigate the MedAge condition, did a lot of blue individuals want it or try to take it? And did it make all of them sick, or was that just specific to Cussie?
That's the side effects of that medicine. And it was originally the medicine, methylene blue is originally used to treat carbon monoxide poisoning. Anyways, yes, it's a very strong and wicked medicine, especially when no one's sick. If you think about it, they're not sick. They live a long life. They're sick to the doctor looking at them, or the people, they don't look like them. So there's no reason to take that medicine unless you have acquired methemoglobinemia, and that would be, you know, a life-threatening condition. You would need the medicine.
Susan asks, what libraries did you use for research, or in what other ways did you do it?
Through my interviews, I interviewed mountain men, coal miners, doctors, hematologists, all kinds of people, researched books on plant life and my plant life here in Kentucky, and the floral, the food, everything, interviews.
Fran says, thank you so much for the beautiful writing.
Thank you.
Denise asked if there's more that you could talk to about the historical facts behind the mixed marriages.
The miscegenation laws, it's really in depth, but they go back, if you get a hold of the congressional bills and you want to start studying it, they started in the 1700s. So I can't speak about the laws in your state, only the laws in my state, and they were pretty accurate to the book. So that was Kentucky law.
Mary says this, you said that it's not much different in the hills now than it was in terms of poverty. Are there beliefs that keep them from modernizing or coming down from the mountains to try to better their lives? Or perhaps that's being a bit judgmental and thinking that they need to come down. Are they okay living that way? Yeah, so.
That's their home and they love their home, you know, as anybody, you know, loves their home. They don't want to leave. In the 1800s, the Kentucky people were doing just fine. And the government said, you're not doing just fine. And the missionary said, you're not doing just fine. And the coal company said, we want your land for a couple of dollars. And they came in because they were subsistence farmers. They were mining themselves. They were farming. They were doing just fine. And so you had all these outside groups coming in, killing the land, you know, raping the land, raping the people. And that was pretty much how it got to be in such a bad shape, you know.
Mm-hmm. I suppose in a similar vein, Susan asks, it's interesting that Cussie wanted to learn to speak more properly. Did you not want her to do that? And she says that she understands why she did it in the book, but I think she's asking you, the author, like why you took it the way that you did.
Because it was an honest and accurate depiction of her. She had not gone to school. She had not been away from home. And as she says in the book, she's learning her print from pretty much groceries that come in, cans, discarded newsprint, and so forth that her mother is teaching her.
I love this next question from Alicia. You said that you had to strip away so much for the book. Is there anything at this point that you wish you had left in?
No, I got to do everything I wanted with this book, you know. And I said everything I wanted to say, you know, and it was just right where I wanted it. And I'm so grateful. I had two wonderful editors at my publishing house. And of course, my agent, who is also heavy editorial, and we've been together 7 years or more. And she knows, even though she's a New Yorker, she knows Kentucky almost just like me, better than me. So I'm blessed, you know, with that. I got to be really do it the way I wanted to. Mm-hmm.
That's so great. It seems like many authors, there's always like one scene that they just couldn't fit in for one reason or another.
I mean,
so that's great.
5 years with these people in this book, and nothing was going anywhere. Not that dandelion over there and not that bird on the windowsill. No, I was just determined, you know, and at one point, you know, and I called my agent and I said, you know, not for $1 million. And I said, I will put this trunket, you know, I will not let that happen, you know, because I wanted, you know, the Kentucky people to have a voice that was authentic and true to them, you know, and as a Kentuckian, and I felt I could do that. And of course, with the massive amount of research, I knew that I could at least do it as best as anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Right. Lori in Alaska says, thank you so much for this presentation. I loved the book and learning so much more about Ms. Richardson's research today was very special.
Thank you.
And I have to say, I'm going to jump in here that I heard that in just about every email I was getting from people that said they wanted to be here tonight. Everybody was saying this book was special. This book moved me. And I was getting these notes that like one line this afternoon, like, where's the link? I just need to be able to be there tonight. And it's really lovely when a book has And it's not a book that was out 3 weeks ago. This is a book that people have been reading for these last couple of years now, and they're still discovering it. It's still coming up on Reading Group Guides as one of the guides that people are looking for, and you know, all the books that they're discussing. And that's huge praise, because you know that the shelf life of something is usually about that long. It's like the shelf life of eggs. You know, the book comes, the book goes, and it's either on the list or it's on people's radar. It's on the front table of the store, and then it's gone. And that's not what we're seeing with this book at all. It's really interesting.
I'm so honored, you know, so humble. And I know these women, the Kentucky Pack Horse Librarians, and a few men would be so proud, you know. And I know, you know, my Blueskin people are today, so.
Catherine asks, says, you speak about rising out of poverty. Did you ever feel you were betraying your family or leaving anybody behind?
I'm sorry, what now?
Did you ever feel like as you were becoming more successful, you were leaving your family behind?
My family, they're never left. No, I don't understand. No, I don't leave anybody behind.
And your own growing up was really tough. Your own growing up.
Well, I grew up in a rural Kentucky orphanage. It was very brutal. Right. And so I was pretty much an orphan and have remained an orphan, you know, pretty much my whole life. So it was nobody leaving. I wasn't leaving anybody behind. I think people were leaving me behind. So.
And as time came on, you were bringing the rest of your family along with you, but it was the family you made. It's not the family you were born into.
Right.
That exactly. you created as time went on. I found that really interesting when I was reading your background and realized you had a really tough life growing up too. But by the same token, I could see you finding the joy in those little tiny things as well. Yeah. And I think that that's what you embed onto the page. It's somebody, I think one of the reasons the book works so well is you understood wanting and you understood needing, and you understood the joy when you do get what you want and what you need. And I think that that very much comes across in your storytelling and the way you're proud about this book as well, because it was all you doing it.
Thank you. Thank you.
And on that same topic, Denise wants to ask about your literary influences, but I kind of want to add on to that. What is it you think that gave you so much drive to keep writing and continuing to get better at it?
Well, I've got to say that I have two people specifically. There's a friend, a gentleman writer in California, and he's just always pushed. But it's been my agent. I wrote my first novel, Liar's Bench, and I told my agents, no more. That's it. That's all you're getting from me. And it was a, you know, Kentucky book. And we laugh about that today, but they just had such faith in me. And they let me write the way I wanted to, the way I talk, you know, at the kitchen table and tell you a story. And they were so respective and just everything. But I do want to share some books with you all this evening, mm-hmm. that some Kentucky books that I particularly love. And this is The Woodsman's Daughter. Can you see that okay?
Yeah, we can.
By Gwen Hyman Rubio. That's a wonderful Kentucky author. Here's a wonderful Kentucky author, and they made a movie out of it. Harriet Arnold. Mm-hmm.
Dollmaker.
Mm-hmm. And Jesse Stewart is fabulous, of course, Kentucky author. Here is Effie Waller Smith, mm-hmm. Kentucky author. And this is one of my favorites. I've always loved this book, and many of you all know it because they made a movie out of it or a TV show or something. And that's The Queen's Gambit.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to tell you a funny story about The Queen's Gambit. When we started Book Reporter, my business partner loved The Queen's Gambit so much. He had us all read it on the staff. And here's the crazy thing. He originally bought the rights to do the screen version of The Queen's Gambit and held on to it for years from Tevis Estate. And he wanted to do that in the worst way. Came to a point where he couldn't afford to fund the you know, the option on it anymore. And so had to walk away from it. And he said, and when he heard the way the show was portrayed, it wasn't the way he would have done it. But I was so interested when you were doing research, when I was doing research, looking into your past, when you said that that was one of the books, I remember we all read that when we were first starting the company.
Wow, that's amazing. And it took me forever to actually, I've read this book years and years and years ago, to actually watch the show because I was so afraid they wouldn't do it justice. I did like the show, but yeah. I was so afraid.
The one thing he felt was she was so pretty in the show. And he didn't think that was one of the things that was part of her character was she wasn't beautiful. She wasn't striking. She wasn't whatever. And he just felt that that was one of the things that had, you know, been such a flip. And a lot of people said that's the thing that made her different was before she was like every person, you know? So, but when I saw you like that book, I was like, oh my gosh, there's like a shared history there. I love it.
And if you like the setting of Bookwoman, Got Pretty, this one is an Appalachia setting, Got Pretty in the Tobacco Field.
And we'll put those books in the show notes as well. We're going to put a video up of this, and we'll put this in the notes so that you have further reading materials as well. We'll make sure we put them in the Reading Group Guides and Book Reporter newsletter. So anybody who's watching tonight, you'll at least be able to have a way to go back and find those books again if you weren't writing down right now.
And this, I think that's most of the questions. This seems like a really good place to kind of close, but I will ask one more that a lot of people have been asking, which is, do you have any knowledge of a movie for your book?
Not for my book. No. There won't be probably a movie for my book.
Okay. So I want to ask you one more question. You have a writer's retreat on your property. I think it's on your property called Shy Rabbit. And I know that this is not something that's in because of COVID days, like it's one of the, you know, 55,000 things we're not doing right now, but tell us about Shy Rabbit because it sounds like I went up and looked at it on your site. It looks like such a great idea of giving back to writers.
Yes. When I sold this book, you know, this was something I hoped to do. I had some wild land here in Kentucky, and I wanted to put a tiny home, and it was the first tiny home with a foundation and a, you know, permanent home built in Kentucky, and it was a way to pay it forward to writers. I just felt so blessed that so many wonderful things had happened, so that's what I used my money with for that, and it was just a way to pay it forward, and you can apply online, and it's a residency, and you come to Kentucky and have a very quiet, tranquil setting with deer and fox and everything you could want.
Yeah, just looked wonderful. The pictures, I encourage everybody to go look online at what you've created and put together because it's got so much of your spirit in what's that of giving back and sharing. And I just got that on the page. And you know, there are a lot of authors that make money or they sell a book and all these kinds of things. But I feel like you definitely wanted to give back to the writing community at the same time. It's like your little part of Troublesome Creek. It's your part of giving back to people. And I really felt it was fun to go out and look at the pictures of what it was like. I'm like, gee, how much of a book do I have? Could I go apply? So it was great. It's really well done.
And we hope to open it up to all artists, you know, musicians, knitters, whatever, you know, art people. My first resident was a librarian.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really nice. But yeah, we go online and apply and we welcome you, you know, but it's just it doesn't have any internet though, you know, your phone. So you will be having to write or to create, you know.
I can think of a couple of writers that should go there because they said they're spending way too much time on the internet. So I think that'd be a really good thing to do. I think it'd be perfect. Kim Michelle, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It has meant so much to the audience tonight. It's been a very, very special evening for us. So thank you so much for being a part of it.
Thank you. Thank you everyone for having me and welcoming me and for your thoughtful, kind questions. I'm so appreciative.
Right. Now you can get back to celebrating your anniversary. Happy anniversary from all of us.
Thank you. Thank you.
And for our readers, I'm going to share with you what we're going to be doing next time for our next Bookachino Live book group. Our next book group will be held on Thursday, May 20th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and our guest will be Robert Kolker, who will be discussing his New York Times bestseller, Hidden Valley Road. This book was a huge hit in hardcover, again in paperback. It is just a wonderful, wonderful story that he did a ton of research for. We want to go with something that's nonfiction this next time around. Sign up will be available probably in a little while tonight on Book Reporter and on Reading Group Guides. And we're also going to make tonight's talk available on YouTube and our podcast next week. So if you were only able to get part of this tonight and you want to check back later on, you'll be able to do that. And remember to stay on top of everything that we're doing at the Book Report Network, our Bookuccino Live events, our Bookuccino Live book groups, contests that we've got on the site. Don't forget to sign up for our newsletters, because you'll be on top of everything that's happening at the network as well. So we thank you for joining us. These are very special evenings. This is just the third that we've done. Robert will be the fourth, and we welcome an opportunity to be able to reach out to our readers and also to hear your questions for these authors at the same time as well. Means a lot to us. For us, it's not just Book Reporter, a discussion one way. It's really about a community of people. So thanks so much for joining us tonight. Thank you for listening to Book Reporter Talks To. Don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Support us by sharing on social media or by telling a friend about us. And we look forward to next time on Book Reporter Talks To. Thanks to the producer of today's episode, Austin Rue.